The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
Hello, I'm Jan Daly, and this week the Arts Podcast looks back at 60 years of British design and asks what the future holds. I'm joined by the furniture designer Matthew Hilton, the author, curator and principal of Edinburgh College of Art, Dr. Christopher Bruard, and the FT's arts writer, Peter Aspen. Christopher is co-curator of the V&A Museum's forthcoming exhibition, British Design 1948-2012, Innovation in the Modern Age. It opens on the 31st of March and runs until August, by which time London's Olympic Games will be in full swing. That's no coincidence. For 1948, the starting date of the V&A's ambitious survey was also the year of London's so-called austerity Olympics. With all eyes on London this summer, the curators aim to display the best of British innovation and taste. But what characterises Britishness? Can Britain be called a leader in design when its manufacturing industry is all but dead? And what links an E-type Jaguar to a Laura Ashley dress? Peter, the exhibition is chronological, tracing the movements and fashions of the past 60 years. What story does it tell?
Well, it's the story. It's the wider story of Britain, as you might expect. My favourite part, the early parts, you get this incredible surge of idealism after the war, fantastic modernist design, but a very democratic impulse at work, which is fantastic. And then you get the years that I remember very vividly as I was growing up, the years of subversion, I think the curators call it, where great flair, great design flair, really rubbing up against the establishment and looking to provoke at every opportunity. And then the end, which I found a little bit, made me a little bit sad and depressing, really, where you get this the professionalisation of design and corporate control very much coming in, and you get the grand buildings, the grand projects, and it splits into those three themes rather neatly, I think, and cleverly.
Christopher, the exhibition you've curated is about design, but it takes in fashion, furniture, fine art, graphic design, photography, ceramics, architecture and industrial products. Can all these really be linked?
Well, we came to our material with a very Catholic understanding of design in its broadest sense. But I think the exhibition, the content of the exhibition also reflects the collecting of the V&A over 60 years as much as it does a history of British design. So all of those elements are linked by the fact that at various times curators were interested in taking in what was representative of contemporary and modern life. I think design as understood in 1948 is very different to design as understood in 2012. So there's that shifting boundaries. One of the wonderful things about the exhibition and seeing that range of objects and media in place is that you do get surprising connections between, for example, textiles and industrial product or film and paintings from the art school. So there are strong visual connections between them as well.
Matthew, you've worked for a number of different companies as a designer, including Habitat as their head of furniture. Your job must have changed a great deal over the years, particularly with the advent of computers.
Well, I started my career in 79, and we were using pencils, paper and model making as a way of designing. A lot of sketching. And computers have changed things dramatically, I think, for the better, by far. We now can design in much more detail. We get things right far more often, and things are much, much faster. I can, you know, as everybody knows, we can send a drawing now around the world and it's received in a factory and something can be made the next day. There are computer-controlled cutting machines. There are all kinds of fantastic developments.
How about your very beautiful Balzac armchair?
Thank you.
That was
pencil and and polystyrene, and the sculpture or form exploration of form is still a very important part of it. But we're doing that with virtually, I mean, we still do cut up bits of polystyrene and cardboard and make things with clay and so on. But that's a very early part of the process.
Peter, post-war British planners and designers believed that great design could actually build a better society, could really, some even believed it could sort of prevent the next war. Do you think that design can make life better in really important ways?
Sure. I don't think it can prevent wars. As I said, there was this amazing, you know, following the war, and in art and design generally, you know, we had the Arts Council, we had the Edinburgh Festival, we had all these very civilising forces, and design was part of that, a real wish to make, to improve the quality of people's lives. But I think the democratic impulse is really important there, you know, that it wasn't, you know, we've come to an age now where we use the adjective designer in this very weird way to denote something exclusive, aspirational, and elitist. And what you really get the sense from in this early part of this exhibition is design is the exact opposite of that. And, you know, I have at home, I have a wonderful Urkel sideboard, you know, and it was not expensive. It was produced, you know, in for mass numbers. But it was properly made. It's a proper piece of furniture, and it's fantastic. And I love the early part of the show for those things.
You're absolutely right. There's a sort of democratic impulse in the design of that moment in the 40s and 50s. There's also a strange sort of, for me at least, patrician, almost top-down. This is the design that will do people good, will improve their lives. I think you then get a real shift in the 60s and onwards where, you know, with the rise of individuality, it's actually about creating design for yourself in more of an ad hoc way, and a rejection of some of those paternalistic values.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then the designers themselves turned into rather kind of individualistic superstars, didn't they? I mean, is there a relationship between the decline of manufacturing and the rise of the designer?
I think around the Festival of Britain and that great democratic and social aspect of design, I think, unfortunately, that was also the beginning of the decline in industry in Britain. And designers had to forge things for themselves. In Britain, you know, industry was dying. The only way to get, in furniture anyway, to get things made was to go to Italy or do it yourself. And when you're starting out your career, doing it yourself is much easier. So it, I think it did create that that frustration that helped people like me and Tom Dixon and Ron Arad and Jasper and so on to push ourselves out there. So in some way, that difficulty was creative.
Chris, do you think that it is sensible to talk about Britain as a global leader in design, as the exhibition, I believe, does? But given this point about British manufacturing being all but over, the divorce of the designer from the process of making must be something that the exhibition also traces.
It does, and I think it is possible to talk about Britain as a global leader in various aspects of its design culture. It's textiles, and you know, I know the textile industry has declined in terms of the way it existed pre-Second World War, but the textiles produced from the 40s to the 50s, just in terms of pattern making, colour, and experimentation with materials, are absolutely excellent, and they jump out at you in the show as something that's incredibly special. And I think it's fair to say, you know, in the final sections of the exhibition, that in terms of architecture, global impact of British-based firms has been extraordinary, whether you agree or disagree with the quality of that architecture. In terms of branding, I suppose, it's very powerful.
But it becomes quite complicated, doesn't it, simply because the world is so much more globalised.
Yeah.
So you have Zaha Hadid's aquatic centre in the Olympic Park. To what extent is that an archetype of British design? I mean, she is British-based, but yet it's her first completed project in England. You know, it's taken a very long time for us to embrace it.
Yeah.
So I think that issue, not only in design, in art as well, has become much more complicated.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we try to avoid in the exhibition telling a very simplistic story and promoting UK PLC in the way that perhaps a trade organisations or other sorts of institutions might. So we do tell a very layered story, I think, and it would be a mistake, although the title is British Design, to think of it as somehow characterising elements of the design culture that are peculiarly British. It's really about design in Britain. So designers born in Britain, trained in Britain, based in Britain. But I don't think we're really trying to push a story that this is classic British design in the way that in the 1980s, you know, one was always talking about Italian design, Spanish design, in the 40s, Scandinavian design. That, I agree, Peter, it's not possible at all to talk in those terms.
One of the things I liked about the show is that it actually doesn't tell a very firm story at all. At the formal opening last night, Lord Rogers made reference to the fact that in the early days of the V&A, it sort of resembled a souk in Marrakesh. It would have all these sort of funny little corners where you'd go and see it. And I'm not saying it's like a souk because it's far too beautifully designed in itself to be like that. But it is something just to sort of walk around and sort of discover bits and links for yourself. There's not this great thumping central narrative, which I think it's to its credit.
Matthew, after the Second World War, Britain invested in its art schools, and presumably you yourself were a product of this moment when there was real kind of optimism about the future that was there. Now that even the art schools are under threat, do you think that the young designers these days are having a tougher time, or that there is good design training?
I think there's definitely good design training, yes. There are some very good schools here. I'm often asked whether it's harder for students coming out of colleges now or universities than it was when I graduated. It's a very hard question to answer. I don't know that it's possible to answer. There are more opportunities, far more opportunities. We're globally far better known. The internet has changed things vastly, but there are far more students.
But do you think the quality of training is still as good as it was in your day?
Well, we're attracting a lot of people here. Mm. Whether that's real evidence, I'm not sure. I go to colleges and I see good work, and I talk to tutors who are very passionate and know what they're doing. The schools I go to, which I must admit are London-based, are still very, they still regard making as being a very important part of design. And although we're using computers and sending files around the world, as a designer, you need to understand how things are made.
It must be so intimidating. I can't help thinking, being a student, you know, because it's just all that, you know, even this show, you know, it's all there. There's this incredible self-conscious realization of Britain's design history, and compared to what it must have been like for Brian Eno, or, you know, just thinking, oh, why don't I put some feathers in my clothes, and, you know, and plus this playing with pastiche and all that, and I don't know, it must be terrifying for a design student these days, I would have thought.
Terence Conran said about the V&A show that it made him feel intensely optimistic about the future of the country because it demonstrates our innovation, creativity and diversity in its full splendour. did it have that effect on you, Peter?
Well, as I said before, I felt, you know, the end of it, and maybe, you know, maybe it's my age, you know, but the end of it, video games, Lara Croft, you know, it didn't really do it for me very much, I'm afraid. And I did get this sense of this sort of globalised mush and things being rather interchangeable. I could be wrong, but I felt very nostalgic for the earlier parts of the show.
One of the other useful things that that Sir Terence Conran said at the at one of the dinners for the opening of the exhibition was that this was an exhibition that every politician should come to see, because one of the useful things it does, I think, it demonstrates at moments of recession, for example, there are great outbursts of creativity in response to the difficulties of the times, and you can see that at various moments throughout 60 years. So the story of British design, in a sense, although we can become elegiac and sentimental, does offer moments of hope and models for different sorts of practices.
If you had to choose one object that in some way sums up the direction of design over the last few decades, what would it be? I bet yours is going to be a car, Peter.
Well, yeah, of course, it's inevitable. There's only one answer to that. There is the most gorgeous E-Type Jaguar there. Everything about it, the colour, it's just so beautiful.
Is it racing green?
No, it's a very subtle grey. It's, yeah, gunmetal, yeah. It's, yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. I've no idea whether this says anything about the direction of British design, but I want it.
I immediately thought of a car as well, but I think the new Aston Martins are fantastic. They are amazing quality. They're fantastically advanced machines. They're beautifully, beautifully made. They're absolutely modern, but they have a link with the tradition, and I think that's a very good statement.
Well, there's a piece we commissioned for the show from Hussein Shalayan, which is a beautiful egg-shaped tulle dress that's white at the bottom, and it has red trickling down from the top, and it's absolutely stunning. It takes my breath away when you see it. It's a sculptural piece, a conceptual piece, if you like, so it plays with the boundaries between fashion and art. Hussein Shalayan, a Turkish Cypriot, son of immigrants, trained at Central St. Martin's, with a vivid imagination and an ability to capture the zeitgeist and you know, make you gasp in wonder. So that for me is the sort of quintessence of a certain sort of design produced in Britain. There's a piece at the beginning of the exhibition from the Festival of Britain, the Skylon, a beautiful drawing by James Gowan. And for me, there's a direct link between a Shalayan wondrous dress that's about something possible and ineffable and this illuminated band of light that floats in the sky and allowed Londoners to wonder at the possibilities of the future. They're both doing the same thing, and yet they're divided by 60-odd years.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much to my studio guests, Matthew Hilton, Christopher Bruard, and Peter Aspland, and to you for listening. The Arts Podcast was produced by Griselda Murray-Brown.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.